Hello and welcome to the Clinical Oncology Podcast. This is part two of our series, linked to our recent special issue on proton beam and particle therapy. In part one, we heard from Professors Steve Hahn and Anthony Zeitman of the US on the experience there of using proton beam therapy and the associated benefits and challenges. In part two of this three-part series, we'll be hearing from Professor Marco Durant, who will be demystifying the physics that underpins charged particle therapy. Professor Durant is a world-leading expert in radiation physics and radiation biology, and his research career has included time working with NASA and the National Institute of Radiological Sciences in Japan. He currently works with the Trento Institute for Fundamental Physics and Applications in Italy and the Department of Physics at the University Federico II in Naples. Professor Marco Durant, thank you so much for joining us. I just wanted to start off by asking about what charged particle therapy is and specifically how it differs from traditional X-ray-based radiotherapy.
Yes, thank you. Both X-rays and charged particles are used in oncology to kill tumor cells. It's ionizing radiation. So ionizing radiation causes damage in DNA of the cells and eventually can kill tumor cells. So they have exactly the same goal. But there are two kinds of difference. The first difference is the physics. The problem of X-rays is just like light. If you put a filter between a source of light and your eye, the intensity of the light will be reduced. So if you have a deep tumor and you send the X-rays and you want to kill the tumor with X-rays, the X-rays will go through normal tissue. And the dose, the energy deposited in the normal tissue will be higher than the dose to the tumor. So if you really want to kill the tumor without killing the patient, which is the final goal of radiotherapy, you have to irradiate from many different angles to crossfire on the tumor. So at the end, the dose on the tumor will be higher than the dose to normal tissue, but you irradiate a lot of normal tissue, very large volume. If you use charged particles, the physics is different because charged particles deposit most of their energy at the end of the range. So when they enter in the body, they are very fast, and they lose little energy. But then gradually they slow down, and when they are really close to the end of their range, they deposit a very large quantity of energy. This is called the Bragg peak. So this is ideal for therapy, if you think about, because you have a low dose in the normal tissue and a high dose in the tumor. So if you use a single beam or two beams, I mean a very limited number of beams, you can easily kill the tumor, reducing the side effect in the normal tissue. So that's the main physical advantage of charged particles is the Bragg peak. This advantage is shared by every particles, protons, helium, carbon ions, oxygen ions. But then there are also biological differences between the different charged particles used.
You talked a little bit about that there are different types of charged particles. And I think the ones we know most about are carbon ions and protons. So can you tell us a little bit about that and what the differences are between them?
As I said, in principle, the Bragg peak is something shared by all charged particles. It's simply the physics. You know, the physics of the interaction of charged particles is based on the ionization. You have a charged particles that go into a target tissue. The ion, which is charged, sees the free electrons. There is a Coulomb interaction, and there is a simple ionization. Fine, this is true for everybody. But the difference is that if you take a heavier ions, if you go from protons to helium to lithium, beryllium, and so on and so forth, the density of ionization increase. So you have many more ionizations many more interactions along this track, is what the physicists call the mean free path. So the mean free path is the distance between two ionizations. It's a little bit like when you go into a party. You know, if you go into a party and you know nobody, you walk in the party and you have very little interaction with the people there. This is like a proton. A proton has a limited number of interaction per unit track. This is also called LET, linear energy transfer. But if you are a heavy ion, like carbon ions, then you have a lot of interactions along the track. And this means a short mean free path. So you interact many times. You have many friends in the party, so you interact with all people in the party. And a short mean free path means a high LET, a high linear energy transfer. So that's the physical difference. But what is the result of this difference in the different LET, let's say? Well, the result is that generally when you increase the LET, which means you reduce the mean free path, you increase the biological effectiveness of the particles, what people call the RBE, the relative biological effectiveness. Why is that? Well, just to imagine why, I told you that you reduce the mean free path. Now, if you reduce the mean free path down to a size of 2 nanometers, let's say, you are exactly on the size of the DNA molecule. So this means that if your mean free path is 2 nanometers, you make an ionization in one strand and the ionization in another strand, and you can really cut the DNA. That's why you are more effective when you go up in LET. There are also physical differences between the different particles. Even though the Bragg peak is the same, there are two main differences. One is the lateral scattering. Protons are light, of course. It's only one proton. So every time they have an interaction, they scatter. And this is a problem in therapy, you know, because they are not enough focused. So you have a sort of penumbra around your target. Heavier ions scatter very little because they are much, much heavier. And then, of course, they are much more straight, and you can have treatment plans that are much more sharp and focused. On the other hand, heavy ions can have fragmentation, this projectile fragmentation, which means that they are broken while they travel through the tissue, and they produce fragments that can go outside of the target.
So then, pulling all those things together, which one would you say is better, carbon ions or protons, or does it depend on the context?
Right, that's really the big question, you know, because you say, okay, I have now protons and carbon ions, which is is there a silver bullet? I mean, some kind of magical bullet that can kill all the tumors? Well, the answer is not, you know, because this is really depending on the circumstances. So clearly, if you want to have a very sharp treatment plan, you know, with no lateral scattering, let's say that you want to go into in what is called hypofractionation, you want to treat the tumor with only one fraction, very high dose, only one fraction, you have to be careful that there is no high dose in the surrounding tissues. And then the penumbra that you have with protons due to lateral scattering is a problem. You like to use carbon ions. Same thing if you have a very radioresistant tumor or a very hypoxic tumor that are very resistant to radiation, then it will be better to use carbon ions because they are biologically more effective in the tumor, and this will give you a further advantage. On the other hand, though, there are two problems with carbon ions. One is that since they are heavier, they can cause more harm also in the normal tissue. So, for example, if you have the pediatric patients where you really want to keep the normal tissue complication as low as possible, you would rather use protons than heavy ions. And, of course, the other problem is the cost. The increase in the weight of the particle that you use comes with the cost because you have to build accelerators that are bigger and bigger, and these are more and more expensive. So here it's a matter of cost-benefit ratio. So you really have to justify the use of heavier particles, justifying its use based on clinical results. You know, the rationale is all there. The physical rationale, the biological rationale is clear, but is this rationale then translated into a real measurable clinical advantage or not? This is still a big question because we don't really have phase 3 clinical trials that prove that carbon ions do better than protons.
And so you've alluded to the question as to, you know, where the clinical benefit might be. Where do you think we will see the most clinical benefit of carbon ions in future?
You certainly expect the maximum benefit when you take very radioresistant, very hypoxic tumors. This can be, for example, pancreas cancer, where there is a trial in Japan which is very, very interesting and very promising. Many kinds of sarcomas that are really radioresistant tumors, and also there are many results on large, unresectable osteosarcomas that are extremely promising. Some head and neck tumors, where it is very important to be very sharp in the treatment plan. So in all these cases, one will definitely expect to see a clear advantage of heavier ions compared to protons.
You've already talked about that there are other charged particles and heavier ions being investigated for use in radiotherapy. Are any of these going to be used in clinical practice, do you think?
I think very soon we will see at least two particles in clinical trials. Pretty soon, especially Heidelberg is working very hard to bring these particles to the clinical level. One is helium and the other is oxygen. The reason is this one. I mean, as I said, when you increase the LDT of the particle, let's say the ionization density, you know, when you increase the charge of the particle, you gain in biological effects, but you increase the risk of side effects. So people is interested in using oxygen, which is slightly heavier than carbon, for very radioresistant tumors. So in cases where the tumors are really very, very resistant, one can say, okay, let's take the risk of a little bit higher normal toxicity, but let's use a heavier ions like Mb oxygen. If we think to use ions heavier than oxygen, this was done in Berkeley many years ago. In Berkeley, people even used argon for treatment of some patients. But the problem there is that really the normal tissue toxicity is going to be high. And moreover, also from the physical point of view, you start to have troubles because you have so much fragmentation of the projectile that your dose will go down instead of going up in the Bragg peak. On the other hand, if you want to use ions that are lighter than carbon but heavier than protons, like helium, for example, this is a good compromise because helium, from the biological effect point of view, is very close to protons, so which is very close to X-rays. You know, so it's something we know, and we are not very much concerned about normal tissue toxicity. But from the physical point of view, you get some advantages because helium has much less lateral scattering than protons have. So the treatment plan will be much sharper, much more precise than you can have with protons. And for this reason, in Heidelberg, for example, they are planning to use helium for pediatric patients because they think that there is not major risks of normal tissue toxicity. And on the other hand, there is a better treatment plan, and so it is expected to have better results.
Thank you for that. You mentioned earlier about cost, so I just wanted to get an idea of how expensive these machines are. And for instance, are carbon ion treatment machines a lot more than proton treatment machines?
The cost now is certainly a big issue because especially in the United States, there is a lot of discussion on whether the additional cost is justified by the clinical results. So let's say that these days, if you buy a LINAC for X-ray, the price range between, let's say, $2 million and $5 million. If you buy a proton therapy machine, a single room now, so which means single room, single gantry, this is now about 20 million.
And is that what, US dollars or euros or?
Yeah, let's say euros, let's say euros, about 20 million euros. Of course, if you want more rooms, you easily go to 50, 60 millions. If you want the carbon ions, it's very difficult to stay below 120, 150 million euros. So you enter, let's say, in a scale of price. Let's say carbon ions is almost as expensive as a Boeing 747. You know, a Boeing 747 costs about $200 million. Or if you want a comparison with the football, if you are a football player, there is Messi, the famous Argentinian player from Barcelona. He's worth 200 millions. So we are talking about Messi. If you want carbon ions, you are really buying Messi. You know? If you want protons, of course, then you are in the range, let's say, of 20 to 80 millions. So you are in the range of a ship. Let's say of the cost can be a ship, or if you want, in the range of cost of heroin. I don't know if there is any English player that comes to your mind, you know. So generally speaking, clearly the cost is higher, and there is a huge effort in trying to reduce the cost. Reducing the cost is one of the main objectives. To reduce the cost, you need to have accelerators that are smaller and more compact, because you know that's not really for the cost of the accelerator, but it's the cost of the building where you have to host the accelerator. I mean, if it is like now, you know, with the diameter, which is typically 15 to 20 meters in diameters for these rings, then you really need huge buildings, and the cost goes up. But if you could have much more compact accelerators, this will reduce the cost. Much more compact accelerators can be done with superconducting magnets, for example, which is now already ongoing in proton therapy. The new proton therapy cyclotrons are generally with superconducting magnets, so that they are much smaller. Or in the very future, let's say the dream is to have this laser-driven accelerator, because in principle, a laser-driven accelerator can be almost tabletop, you know, where essentially you have a. But this is unfortunately still far in the future. Reducing the cost, of course, is one important aspect. The other one, of course, will be increasing the benefit. If you want to reduce the cost-benefit ratio, you can do these two things. Increasing the benefit means using particles for more kind of disease. For example, very popular is becoming the use of particles for breast cancer. And that's not really because you need to be more effective against the breast tumor, which is radiosensitive, but because you want to spare the heart. And again, if you have a left breast cancer, and if you use particles stop. So you can spare the heart completely, but if you use photons, this is almost impossible. The heart goes in the treatment plan, and you have a fairly high dose in the heart, which is then correlated to late cardiovascular risk. On the other hand, there is a lot of studies now on saying, why don't we use the Bragg peak for non-cancer diseases to treat benign conditions? You know, the problem in radiotherapy in general is that very often you have a good local control, but you have poor survival because of metastasis. But if you have a benign disease, the story is all in local control. One benign disease now very much under study is the heart arrhythmia, in particular this ventricular arrhythmia. For ventricular arrhythmia, you need to ablate an area of the heart, and you generally do this with a catheter that goes through the vein, and then you burn this little area of the heart using heat, essentially. This is a very invasive procedure with a high rate of failure. If you can do it non-invasively with radiotherapy, that would be wonderful. We actually did a preclinical study on a swine model with carbon ions that was very successful. And very recently in the United States, people with X-rays treated patients, real human patients. It's a paper that just came out on New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the best journals in the field, for ventricular tachycardia using SBRT, stereotactic body radiation therapy. So it's a field where I expect a lot of interesting news in the field. Another point, which is always under discussion concerning the benefit, is the combination with drugs. In most of the cases, the patients are not only treated with radiotherapy or with surgery that are local treatments, but are also treated with systemic drugs, chemotherapy, targeted drugs, and these days a lot of immunotherapy, which is, of course, now the big trend in clinical oncology. Now, the question is whether using particles you can improve the effect of immunotherapy. And I think there is at least one very simple reason why this should happen. And this is because, as I said before, if you use particles instead of X-rays, you irradiate very little normal tissue. Now, if you want to have an immune response against your tumor, you need to have immune cells. If you kill the immune cells with X-rays, because you irradiate such a large volume of body, it will be difficult to have an immune response. But if you use a strategy like particle therapy, where the normal tissue irradiated is very small, then you can expect a better immune response. So that's why this field is also now very hot, very much studied in many trials and preclinical experiments.
Thank you. So you've pointed out some really exciting areas. You've obviously been researching this field for many years now. Over the next 5 years, what are the research questions that you and your lab will be looking into?
Yeah, I think at the moment we are, in fact, focusing on this immunotherapy. We believe that immunotherapy can be really the future. The results that have been obtained in melanoma are astonishing, and there are also now trials in non-small cell lung cancer that are really very, very promising. So we firmly believe that the combination of radiotherapy and immunotherapy can be a key solution in many cancers, let's put it this way. But one of the main problems we are tackling now is the timing. I mean, when is the right timing between the irradiation and the use of the drugs? Shall we use the drugs before the irradiation, during the irradiation, after the irradiation, at which time? You know, these problems are not easy to be solved. You need a lot of preclinical experiments, which is essentially what we are doing now.
Thank you for discussing this important area in such an excellent way. You've written an excellent article in this special issue of Clinical Oncology as well. What would you say the key message that you had within that article is, and you think that readers and listeners should be taking away?
The key message is that carbon ions in particular has already proven to be a very effective and safe therapy. There is sometimes, I mean, this is not completely understood, but carbon ions are around since more than 20 years. The Japanese started their trials back in 1994, so it's now many years that we have clinical evidence of how effective can this therapy be. So I think this is beyond doubts. The only thing that remains to be really proven is whether it's cost-effective, let's say. If you can really prove that eventually this methodology is cost-effective. And when I say cost-effective, I certainly include the fact that having a patient that is not recurrent, is not coming back, is also cheaper for the health system. I mean, this is something that people forget. I mean, sometimes, I mean, clearly it's not only a matter of local control, it's a matter of what happens later. So I think this is the first point. The first point is that it is already known that carbon ions are very effective. It remains clinically remains to be proven the superiority compared to protons and X-rays with phase 3 clinical trials. It is very important to go on with phase 3 clinical trials. I think there is no alternative to phase 3 clinical trials. However, they have really to be well designed. Because, you know, if you make a clinical trial where essentially you use the same dose to the tumor and almost the same dose volume histogram, you don't really expect any difference. So if you don't find any difference, it is because your clinical trial is designed in a way that cannot show any difference. And this can create problem, can create skepticism. So I think it's important to have clinical trial, but it's also very important to design these clinical trials really well and really properly on those tumors where you expect to see a difference.
We hope you enjoyed listening to this podcast, and look out for the third and final part, which we'll be releasing next month. This features Professor David Sebag Montefiore of the University of Leeds and Dr. Ra Jenner, who has been the guest editor of this excellent special issue.